I picked my own introducer. My name is Benoit Shaw, and I am a member of Alamon. Hi, y'all. Well, first of all, I need to remind myself that I am a substitute speaker. It was not the first choice here. It probably just got his name out of the hat. My sponsor was asked to be the speaker here at the 20th anniversary of this conference, and she's kind of under the weather, and I bring her greetings to all of you. She said to tell you that she loved you and wished you a great conference and happy anniversary. I'm sorry, she just fell flat on her ass. Are you hurt? So thank you for committing, for giving me this honor, and I truly think it's an honor. I just, you know, because it is the 20th anniversary, of course, we've been going over old memories and old timesakes, and just a flood of memories had just bombarded me for a couple of weeks, and people who are here and people who aren't here, and some of you are all so sick of hearing about people you do not know, and I really don't care. Curly missed my husband. I moved over here from Texas and was going to start a women's conference, and Roz Kinchin and I looked up a bunch of Baptist retreats and Methodist retreats, and those of you who remember Roz, she was giving me directions on how to get to different places, and we wound up in a couple different states. And we found this place and just fell in love with it, so we signed it up for our women's conference. And I was in Lubbock, Texas when Jim and I met, and I went to two conferences, Lakeside Conference in Brownwood, Texas, and Cedar Glen Conference down by Happy, Texas. And those were two things, like I always did, those are my committed conferences. And when Jim and I were moving over here, it was the same weekend of the Canyon Conference, I mean of the Cedar Glen Conference, so we stopped there and experienced that. And he had not ever been to one like it. And the next fall was September, and I asked him to go to Brownwood, and he did. So we went there, and he experienced that. And a man named Bob White, who was, you know, he was one of our giants. Every area has their local giants, I think, and Bob was ours. And Bob pulled him aside and said, come go with us. We're going to have a board meeting, and you might want to. Thank you. I was just sick to bust you. We were going to have a board member. Why don't you come and experience this? So he went in, and when that was over, he told Jim, he said, you might want to start one of these over in Oklahoma, and we'll help you. And so Jim gave me this information. I said, well, you know, we found this women's conference, and so a bunch of us came down and went to this camp, and the Canyon was born. And it's so phenomenal to me to watch it 20 years later. There was just like five or six of us in that living room getting this thing put together and coming down here and hoping. And I remember the first one was done and how it was and how we felt. And like 3 years later, this little young little alcoholic girl come walking by and she said, something about being here last year and how good it felt to be here this year. And then it dawned on me there was history here already with 3 years. There was history and how important history is. You get that feeling of connection. So I tell you that to let you know that this comes from Giants. Bob and Marceline started Lake Brownwood. They started that because they had been asked to talk in Blackstone, Virginia, one of the first ones of this kind of conference anywhere. And so this format has gone all over the country, and one of the guys that Jim sponsored, this Montana Bunch, is talking about, they're having one in a couple of weeks called Bear Too. So it's just fabulous. It's a family thing. And I have family here today, and that's incredible. I have my daughter Tracy, 3 years of sobriety. I have my niece Tanya, 2.5 this time. And and my daughter Sheila. And it's, you know, the big book says there's two reasons that Alcoholics Anonymous grew like it did in the beginning. One was the obvious, the people getting sober. And the second huge reason was the reuniting of their families. So I think that's absolutely incredible that I've got so much family here. I could just talk an hour about those three girls, let me tell you that. I came into this magnificent fellowship of ours, February the 7th of 1969. My home group at that time was the Central Group, very active and very family-oriented group. And my sponsors, Pat Clater and her husband, Jack Clater, took me under their wing and showed me how to live this life. And their sponsors, Johnny and Octavia Brooks, threw me in the – they just said, come get in the car, and they took me all over the country. They took me those, paid my way. And it's just been – I just have been wrapped up in this love affair for many, many years. Lubbock was a small old town, and it wasn't much happening in Lubbock. It's flat. There's a mesquite tree every now and then, a little cotton bowl here and there, and cow. And there was absolutely nothing to do. It was in the Baptist Bible Belt, and my mama was Baptist. I mean, pure Baptist. My grandmother was Baptist, and she had left the Methodist, so they weren't too happy with her, and they looked down at her because she wasn't going to go to heaven, and all of her kids and generations to come was going to go to hell. And so there was strife from the very beginning. Mom and Daddy had me and three boys and struggled to make a living. Daddy had a little used furniture store, and we were just your typical, normal, weird people, just, you know, getting along. And my brother broke his neck, broke my father. He wound up in hospital after hospital, and my father lost his business, and my house became a place of dull, aching pain every day. It was always centered around the pain, and the smell there was just terrible. They didn't have the equipment they had today. My brother had used rubbers and latexes and things on his back and in his bottom and his heels, and it all smelled bad, and the flesh smelled bad, and that old... They had some kind of god-awful brown, purple-looking medicine they stuck on that rotting flesh, and it smelled bad. And it was just a place I in summer in Texas, and there was not anything except those evaporated coolers then, and you know how they cool. And it was just a bad place. I just didn't want to be there. Mom and Daddy hardly, I just don't remember them smiling, laughing. I do not remember any laughter in my home, ever, ever. When I was a kid, it didn't happen. It was just hard work and taking care of him 24 hours. It took the whole family to take care of him. And I was just miserable. My folks never said, I love you. My folks never hugged me. There was never any family outings. It was just hard work. And I played out in the streets all the time and grew up out in the streets and learned a lot of things out in the streets and found honky-tonk when I was about 16 and snuck in there, and Sheila was talking about the blinking lights. I know where those blinking lights are. And there's, it's so easy for me to listen to an alcoholic and understand everything they're saying and doing and experiencing just right along with them, with the exception of their using and doing the alcohol. And I'm in using and doing the alcoholic. That's the only difference in my story and any alcoholic in this room. You picked up a drink, I picked up a him. You picked up beer and vodka and whatever, and I picked up Joe, George, Harry, and Tim. And I turned out, I used to be pretty hot in one time. And I was a genuine first class schlep puppy hoe. I'll tell you later, Brian. He said, what? Or what? Or what? Brian's a Yankee. And I just felt worse and worse and worse about all the time, worse and worse about myself. You know, I knew better because my folks were Baptists and there was morals and there was things to do, and I knew better than that. And I could not stop myself. Exactly like I've heard alcoholics say, they cannot stop themselves from drinking. I cannot stop myself from going out to a bar and get a hymn. I can't. Now I can't explain to you why that happened. It's just what I did. There was this huge hole in my soul. It was just huge. And in that hole would creep out and spring out all these things, you know, Al-Anon isms, if you will, that I heard right from this podium from Marcy White many years ago. Control, lack of self-worth, drama queens, expectations, manipulations, lack of humor, vindictive, you know. All these things are in this hole, and they're pouring it out, and I'm trying to get a hymn to stick back in there to get that hole filled. If I could just get that done, I would be okay. This awful loneliness would leave me. I mean, I was so flippin' lonely all the time. In a crowd this size, y'all all know each other. Y'all are having a really good time. Everything's fabulous. And I'm sitting over here with a smile on my face, act like I know who you're doing, and I mean, said Brian knows what that means. You act like you know what you're doing. Maybe I'll explain. I drug myself out of a sick bed to come here this week. And I just wish I could be like y'all and do like y'all and think like y'all and be pretty like y'all and smart and I just couldn't. I didn't have a clue. I'd say something, everybody would go, huh? And just, you know, like I wasn't there. And it was just awful. And I was sitting, one of the big girls took me to the Cotton Club. And God, dog, let me tell you. When I walked in, the smells were so familiar. I mean, it just was so familiar. Old stinking chairs and old stinking rubber mats on the floor and puke and urine and stale smoke and beer and whiskey and, you know, old body sweat and God only knows what was all in that place. And it was the best feeling. It was literally like, this is a safe place. This, you know, this is home. I know this. Maria and did you go? Several of the girls, these California girls are really wussy, let me tell you. They are. I've had a long road to hoe out there. I took them back to Lubbock with me one time, and the first thing I want to do, of course, is honky-tonk. So we took off to find a honky-tonk, and they had changed so much since I've been out there. It was just pathetic. I mean, we went everywhere, and they had carpet on the floor, matching little chairs and cute little fufu candles and lights. And I mean, it was really, really disgusting. And we went for hours. And finally, we found the place called Jiggers Up. And there was about five or six girls, Tracy and Maria and several others. Opened the door. This is it. And we walked in and was looking around, and of course they dressed country. You should have seen how they dressed country. It was so embarrassing. And every drunk in the room looking, what is that? I mean, and I said, well, it doesn't look like there's any tables here. And this one drunk looked up and he said, if there ain't a table, I'll clear one. So we walked down this side and across the bar, and here was the bar. There was a bunch of guys sitting there, and the prize one, he had a big belly, his teeth was gone, and he had a big beard, very unkempt, and crappy hair, and one leg was gone, and he had a stump going and a crutch, and he's leaned up against the counter, you know, looking at it. And something was said, and I looked at him and I said, hey, don't mess with her. She's my daughter. Matter of fact, they're all my daughters. You leave them alone. He says, we don't want the daughter. We want mama. I had three major alcoholics in my life. I met that first major one out there. There's just a time in your life when you trash yourself so much, you know, you take away all your dignity. You know, nobody took my dignity away. I gave it away. And you just feel so bad about yourself. And you just, you know, you go to lower companions. And I wound up at a place called a Nickname, but that's I think it was called the Avalon Club, actually, but it's called the Bloody Bucket. And it didn't even open until all the others closed, like 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And, I mean, your first-class caliber drunks, you know, show up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you bet on that. I met this man, and he had a lot of money, and he gave me money. And my family was so poor, I never had new clothes in my whole life, and this man gave me some money, and he said, really, you know, I just love alcoholics. They got that swagger and that look. He flipped me a $100 bill, which I'd never seen before. And he said, here, run around on this a while, you know. I was hooked and in love. And I found myself shacked up by this man, and I found myself pregnant by this man, and I had my child, and this man said he had done all for me he could do and asked me to leave. And I was just, I was crushed. Absolutely, totally, completely crushed. How could he do that? You know, here again, I am such a piece of garbage. And I'm just a nothing. And I have this little girl now, and what in the world am I going to do? And what I do is I try to show you how you've hurt me. What I do is manipulate and churn and hurt and drag and tear people up. And I went over to another honky-tonk that they absolutely were total enemies with, this honky-tonk in the Bloody Bucket, and got this guy drunk and took him over and flaunted myself in front of the gambler. This guy was a gambler, and that's where he got all his money, the bootlegger, and just taunted him with this guy. And, you know, thinking, my plan was, this will make him jealous, and he will come running for me. Well, what he did was he ran for a shotgun and blew this man's head off. Now, I never in 1,000 years thought that would happen. Not in 1,000 years. That was movie stuff, and it didn't happen in reality. And I'll tell you, when they came to my friend Juanita, came to tell me that, and she came over, and it was dawn, and the sun was coming up, and she began to tell me what happened. And I remember that my throat was closing, and my chest was so tight, and I absolutely couldn't breathe. And I was about to face. Now, of course, now I know, but I didn't know at the time. Because everything started turning black, and just this black hole was coming at me. And I thought, my thinking was, wonder where the sun's going. And I was in the pain. I couldn't breathe. And it was just an instant decision, a bow, snap decision. I can't feel this pain. And I stuffed it. I don't know how, where, what, but my head come up, my shoulders went back, and I said, that's too bad. And I carried that for the next some 15 years. And I learned how to stuff those feelings from then to really today. I'm still pretty good at it. Not as good as I was, but I can still do it. And it's a sickness, because the more those feelings get there, they fester and they start oozing and they just take your life over. And I was a pitiful mess. I thought, it was trial and it was just everywhere and it was just pitiful. I humiliated my family. My mom was about through with me. Anyway, and then when this happened, she said to me, I'll never forget her face as long as I live. She said, we don't want you coming in and out of this house. We don't want the neighbors to see you. If anybody asks if you're our daughter, just tell them you're not. That's okay, Mama. You know, that really didn't hurt me. It really didn't, because I knew what she was saying was absolutely correct, the truth. They did not need my stuff, and they were good, hardworking people, and that had been through enough with my brother, and I knew they did not need that, and I just felt really, really bad. Now, my dad would come and get Tracy all the time. He adored Tracy, and they saw her, but, I mean, I just wasn't welcome in their home. Now, I thought, what I've got to do is straighten my life out and get something bigger and better in my life and just change and get out of this horrible life I'm in. So I decided to go with the rodeo grass. It was at the time when people were burning the flags and tearing up their draft cards, and some of you remember that. And Cowboys didn't do it. They did not do it, and they stood tall, and they were Americans. And I thought, that's for me. And so I chose the biggest bull rider, the cutest guy, and had a black hat and tight jeans, cutest bust you've ever seen in your life. And he was a great dancer, and I connived and manipulated myself into his life. And one night we were at the bar, and I don't know what happened, but he was poking me in the chest. And we had great big quart brown beer bottles back then, and I picked up one, as I did many, many times, and just busted it upside of his head and just took him to his knees. And I figured it was a good time for me to get, so I got him. He chased me out of the car and he grabbed me, spun me around, and he looked at me a minute, and he said, I think you just knocked some sense into me. I think we should get married. Now, I did not realize this so many years in inventory, but he liked salty dogs, and I made a big gallon of salty dogs, and I kept him sipping on that for the next 3 or 4 days until I could get him married. Now, I didn't realize that I was pouring poison down the one person that I supposedly loved to get him to do what I needed for him to do, and that's marry me. Because, you see, I never dreamed about being married. Do you hear what I'm saying? Married. I'd lost that dream a lot while I was 12. You know, you got to be a virgin before you can get married. And married to me meant you're respectable. And people look at you, and you have dignity, and you go to church, and you have picnics, and you make ice cream out in the backyard on Sunday afternoons, and the little woman makes curtains for the kitchen and bakes cookies, and the man's mowing the yard. You know, that's married, and I really wanted that. It never occurred to me. I don't know. I don't like soda. I don't know how to soda. I don't like to bake. I don't bake. I don't do any of those stuff, but see, I had dreams. I have dreams. Y'all call it delusions. I have dreams. I want my dreams fulfilled. I want to be married, and I want to have a family, and I want all this stuff to happen. And we got married, and we had a fabulous marriage for the first 6 days. And he went off with Charlie, and he didn't come back. And I started started the drive-bys and the hunting and going in the bars and flipping over tables and hunting the blondes. And it was a nightmare. I had a little boy, just the cutest thing you've ever seen in your life, and I'd have him on one arm and dragging Crazy on the other, and we'd go hunting. And he'd show up to family gatherings, and, you know, I'd be embarrassed, and Tanya's brother, my brother didn't speak to me, and me and Wendy and my kids would come in, and he'd just look and look the other way. My brother didn't speak to me for 26 years, her daddy. I finally figured out what it was, but it took me a long time. He was just an alcoholic. And here we was doing the thing over and over and over and over, watching my kids, you know, just go through a bunch of crap. Just crap. But I put my kids in the back room, don't you know? So they didn't see, they didn't really feel, they didn't really experience. If they'd ask me if anything's wrong, I'd tell them no. They didn't need to know this stuff. They wouldn't know. And just keep them in the back room. Keep them quiet. And me and this cowboy went along for a long time, and then I just, you know, one Thursday, he was going to come in. I knew he was going to come in. I knew he was going to be drunk. I knew it was going to be another fight. And I, you know, I was through. I was absolutely through. I couldn't do it anymore. And I just surrendered, and I picked up the phone and called, and called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they gave me this lady. I went over to see this lady who was a sober member of AA, and she talked to me for a long time. Her husband came in, and they talked to me for a long time, and it was just incredible what they said to me. And I've heard it several times this weekend, hope. There was a little bit of hope there, and they took me to my first meeting, and that's when I encountered Alcoholics Anonymous now and on for the first time, and opened the door, and the first thing that I heard, the first thing I heard y'all do was laugh. That's the first sound of Alcoholics Anonymous, was laughter. And I was hooked. And I started going to those meetings, and finally discovered you're supposed to get a sponsor, and I got a sponsor, and which was Pat. There's another one down there somewhere. And here's one, see. I've noticed all the alcoholics have had lots of water up here. I don't think I want to hear that. And I was going out one door, and there's another door over here, and I was going out the door, always slipping out, because I didn't want you to know. Actually, I was the first Al-Anon in Central Group that came into the program without their husband. Everybody else came couples. And I came without a drunk. And I was an oddity to them. And I was really young. I was 29 when I came in this program. So I was also extremely young. And I didn't know, had I known this, I wouldn't have stayed, literally. But they were watching me, and one went out this one door, and one went out this door, and I chose this one this night, because I would run out as soon as amen was. If you knew me, I wouldn't be welcome here. If I could just stay, just let me stay, and let me be a part of. Let me just listen, and I'll leave. I won't bother you. I won't disturb anything. Just let me listen. And my sponsor chose this one particular door that I chose that night, and said some things to me that only she could say and only I could hear, which was incredible to me. And she became my sponsor later. We just went through the steps, and she bought me a big book and taught me about the disease of alcoholism, and took me to meetings and took me to conferences and put my life back on track. And we started with the 12 steps, and they're incredible. I mean, they're just incredible. My first round of the steps was probably the most heart-wrenching things I've ever done in my life. Because as you all know, you got to surrender, and who wants to do that? And then there was this guy that I didn't know about, didn't want to, thanks. That's Baptist folks, and no part of my life. And I just didn't believe there really was one. And then that fourth step, and Pat was married to one man her whole life. And I just couldn't imagine telling her my stuff, but it was not pretty. Gave her my fifth step, and she, you know, when I got through, she said, I want to thank you for trusting me enough to share your life with me. That just blew me away. I thought, that's strange. And then I watched her like a hawk. At meetings, I'd sidle up behind her and see what she's saying, and if she looked at me different. See, my sponsor was the most important person in my life for a long, long time. I need to rephrase that. My sponsor is the most important person in my life and has been for 33 years. And I wanted her approval and her acceptance more than anybody I've ever known in my life. And I would do any and everything she told me to do to get her acceptance and her approval. And not that I liked it, not that I thought it was going to work or didn't work, but it's just that I needed her acceptance and approval. And she told me, I don't know how many times, I really don't care how you feel about working this stuff. I don't really care how you about picking up those ashtrays. I care about the results, and we're going for the results for you. And that's what she said to me for years. And I, as it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and I did have a spiritual awakening that first go-around, and I've worked the steps many times through the years on just lots of different situations, and each time that 12th step has come true, and I have had this closer and closer walk with God that's just absolutely incredible. After 7 years of living with this practicing alcoholic, and it took me 7 years to understand the disease, to get some compassion for him, to get some feeling for him, to understand why I was even staying there and letting him go little by little. And 7 years, there had been no violence. The minute I walked in, the violence stopped, and they told me some things to do. And one of the guys said, "Won't you try keeping your mouth shut?" Because I was volatile as he was. And 7 years later, he walked in one night and flipped on the light, and I knew he was in a blackout. I could tell by the look on his face that he was in a blackout. And he started beating me up, and I was trying to get out of the bed, and I was all twisted up in the sheets, and my face hit the floor, and it kind of bounced me up, and I looked in the door. And in the door was my daughter and my son. And I know this couldn't have happened, but like 1 minute. And they were at the other end of the house. And they were up and in there and standing in that door. And I'll not forget that as long as I live. My son was doing this little jig. And he was like a little bitty thing. And Tracy's face was just contorted and she was screaming. And so Duke was screaming and Tracy's saying, "Daddy, please don't hit her anymore. Please don't hit her anymore." And I thought, my God. Look at my kid's face. I had, so help me, I had never seen my children's face until that very night. And I looked into their eyes and their faces, and I saw holy hell there. I saw their little black souls, and I thought, oh, my God, what is this doing to my kids? And there was this little click that changed all that, and I got my children out of there. And it was really hard. I was a high school dropout. I had no education. And, you know, when I surrender, God just takes over. And he took over. And next thing I knew, I had a little place to stay. I had a little car. A bunch of people got together and helped me get in nursing school. I went to school. I graduated from that school, and the class asked me to give up and give the class response, and I was up there, you know, just talking, and honey, I was overwhelmed, and just number one, that I passed. You see, I always thought I was stupid. I always thought I was very stupid, that I couldn't do anything, and not being educated is really hard. And I was just thrilled to death that I had, I was a nurse, and we just graduated. And I was thanking people, and I looked down, this whole front section was my AA family. And I looked down, about in the middle was my mom and my daddy. And the neighbors next door, and my daddy punched my man and said, "That's my daughter up there." I could read his lips. Y'all remember the, what was her name? Yeah, Stuart. And as I was talking, I thought, you know, they didn't do one thing different. My folks didn't. Y'all taught me how to make amends and how to make a mend. It wasn't just "I'm sorry," but it was amend. I took me and my kids over there every Sunday after we started going to church, and took them over there to church, and slowly but surely we were allowed in and allowed in their lives, and I made amends to my dad, and then I made amends to my mama, and they took me back in their life. Everybody in my family, I made amends to everybody in my family except my brother, Cotton's daddy. And he wouldn't speak to me, and he wouldn't accept a phone call, and I wrote him a letter. and sent it to him. I'm making my amends and told him what I was doing, what I was in, and could he forgive me. And I never got a response. My mother told me once, I'm just going to tell you this, I'm not going to say anything else. Your brother got your letter, and I said, thank you. And there was no forgiveness there. And, you know, it's one of those things that I really learned about making amends. It's not about the other person. You really want that, but it's about here. That's their stuff to carry, and it's not my stuff to carry. And I didn't feel bad about walking into my own home, my mama's home, when he was there. Now, I must say, when my daddy had cancer shortly thereafter, and being a nurse, I was taking care of him, and he called me in the cafeteria and said, I want to buy you a cup of coffee, and we went in, and he said, if there's anything I can do to help daddy, would you let me know? If there's anything you need to get or have to take care of him, let me know. And I said, I will. And that's the only conversation that he and I had. And then when my father did pass away, he came to me and he said, would you like for me to go get your children? They were in school. And that was the kindest thing. And I knew it was his way of making amends to me. So he went and got my kids and told them about their granddaddy and brought them home. A few years later, my brother took his own life. Because of his drinking, and my nephew gave me my nephew, Tanya's brother, was going through his dad's billfold 5 years after his dad died. And he said, you know, this is for you. He said, I've been through dad's billfold every year, and this is the first time I ever noticed it. And inside that billfold was the Al-Anon, the little bookmark, just for today. And on one side is just for today. On the other side is the St. Francis prayer, which is my favorite prayer. I have St. Francis is all over my house. Prayers everywhere. And it was folded over the St. Francis prayer. And he said, Daddy carried this in his billfold, and I think you should have this. And it was absolutely like a dream come true. I knew at that moment. It's like Sheila said, I knew that my brother had forgiven me at that instant. I just knew it. I graduated. Life was really good. I was self-supporting. It was good. And Tracy turned teenager. And you know, they say you cannot say an alcoholic is an alcoholic. Only they can call themselves an alcoholic. But I heard a man from the podium say, if they quack like a duck, look like a duck, waddle like a duck, chances are they are a duck. And she was waddling and quacking, and the fight was on. The fight was on. She was screaming at me, I hate you, and I was screaming at her, I hate you, and I'd chase her down, she'd run. I do believe the time she was 12 until probably just a couple of days ago, she never told me the truth. Tracy will say, hey, Mom, what do you think about, I'll make it simple, what do you think about me buying a Chevrolet? I'll say, well, let me think about a Chevrolet. Let's say your dad drove the Chevrolet. I mean, Grandpa drove the Chevrolet. And she said, well, I bought it 3 weeks ago. She would say, what do you think about old Joe? I said, well, Joe's all right. He seems like a nice guy. Okay, well, we've been living together for 3 weeks. You just need to know the exact question to ask Tracy. It's not that she lies. You just need to know the exact question. You have to think of everything that's happened the last 20 years and go for the right question, and you will get it. And she would lie to me, and I would believe every word she said. My cowboy husband lied to me, and I believed every word he said. She and the cowboy husband started lying both to me, and I believed what they said. And I just was in this world, and it was, I mean, I was always confused. I mean that sincerely. I was just confused. What did he say? What'd she say? Where'd they go? What did you say? I thought I did that. No, they said I didn't do that. Did I do that? I don't know if I did that. Did I pick that up? Did I drop that?
Who is that? It's not one.
And that was every single flipping day. I didn't know I was living with alcoholism all over my house. It was smeared all over my house, and I didn't know. And I got crazier than a goon. And we finally got to that place where you get that I could no longer tolerate this action in my home. It was killing me. I had a little son, and it was killing my son, and I just couldn't do it. And one night, under horrible circumstances, like me beating her up and opening the door and throwing her out, she left home. And she moved in with somebody and stayed, and then told a giant lie a few months later and came. I probably should really get, their fantasies are just, please call me. She'd been raped by not one man, two men, by knife, throat, and God, I went down there and it was just devastating. I don't think it's funny. I went down there and you can imagine, mothers, your precious little daughter's been raped by two men. I hate every man, I almost run over them if they got in front of me. You know? And this policeman said to me, do you think your daughter could be lying? I went over the desk at him. And come find out she was lying. It was just one of her deals. She's just trying to get out of trouble, that's all. And she wanted to come home. And so she came home and stayed, and she graduated and went off. And, I knew what alcoholic women do because I've heard you talk, and I just didn't want my daughter to be an alcoholic. I tried everything to stop her from being an alcoholic. My son, they called him from school one day and when he was 12, and he'd been sniffing Pam through Pam. You know that you cook with Pam. To this day, I cannot understand that. The first time I ever heard about cocaine, Sheila was saying, well, you roll this cigarette, a dollar bill up, you roll it up, make this little thing, and you sniff it up your nose. I said, up your nose? Why in the world would you put something up your nose? Your nose? I mean, I still don't understand that. Up your nose, And I was trying to say, rescue my son, and I was going to put him in his boy's ranch and still drunk. The cowboy husband found out about it and come kidnapped him and raised him. And my son is a grown man today, and he's not lived with me since he was 12 years old. And there's a lot of scar tissue there, a lot of scar. There's a lot of scar tissue between me and Tracy. There's scars there. You can come to this fellowship and you can do all the things, but, there's consequences to my action. There's consequences of it. And I see it on a pretty regular basis. Not that it's bad and hard. It's not. It gets sweeter and sweeter and sweeter, and I learn tools. I know how to do it. But I pay consequences as a mother about the things that I did. And I had taken inventory about my motherhood when my son went to say, was kidnapped by his daddy. He called me and told me where he was finally. And I had taken inventory about my motherhood, and I found some things that I did was really, really wrong. And I found some things that I did was really, really right. And what was going on was alcoholism. And I had to go to a lot of depth of reading and some meditation and some works and doing some things to make my life different and try to be the best mother that I know how to be. And that's, Tracy talks to me about me like I talk about my mother. And I thought, that is so very weird. And like you talk about your mother, she talks about me. Can you imagine? I mean, I'm her mother. And mother and daughter stuff will go on forever. And we have absolutely the best relationship today we can have. I divorced this guy in that nursing school doing good. And I was in Midland, Texas at a convention, and this man sat down in front of me, and he had these blue eyes, this big, deep voice, and lots of diamonds. And big man. Big. And it was Jim Shaw. And we started dating, and I was going to go out to California and have a life with him. And very last minute, he chickened out and dumped me. And he was just, he didn't know how to do relationships, and he had been single at that time 9 years, and he did not know how to do relationships. As you heard Sheila say last night, I was his fifth and final wife, as I told him I would be. And And so after a while, he got a big coward and just dumped me, and almost at the altar. And I didn't see him for 2 years. Now, when that happened, when he dumped me, I wasn't really particularly angry at Jim because, you know, it finally surfaced. He and I had a great time. He was sober and very active, and I was very active in Al-Anon. Sponsored a lot of people he did, and it was really a neat thing. And when that happened, I thought, you know, God, what? You know, I've done all your lousy work. I've set up the chairs. I've made the coffee. I've swept the floors. I was the group representative. And this is what you do to me. Why? What? And it was like, to me, God has always been this big male figure. The spirit of male. And I thought for whatever reason, my brain went straight to my dreams. And I thought I'll just get back at every man I can see. And I did. With brand new men in Alcoholics Anonymous who were trying to get sober, I went after them like a rattlesnake chases his prey. Just to mess up their life because they were simply there and because they were simply a man. Didn't have anything to do with Jim. Didn't have anything to do with who they were. It was just my sickness spewing out on everybody. And I was manipulating two or three of them at the same time, and one snitched. One of them was a dropout of AA and came back and forth. And he called when I was at Brandwood, Lakeside Conference, actually, and sent a note. The guy, the camp director, got this note and came in the meeting and slipped me a note by Pat Clater. I opened it up, and it said, so-and-so said call him, and she says, and what does he want you to call him for? I mean, I couldn't lie. I was like, think. I said, can I tell you later? And she didn't forget it, and we went out to the... And we, at night, we sat out a blanket, and we sat out there, and I told her what was going on, and I told her what I was doing. And I fessed up, and I finally told her, I said, Pat, I feel like God's betrayed me. And she said, really? Do you feel like you've ever betrayed God? And that little sentence was just like it changed my whole life. And yeah, I knew I had. And then I said, well, we talked over, and I said, you know, I need to tell you something that I've never told anybody. That's been my secret that I thought that I'd overcome, but I haven't. And I don't know why this is true, Pat, but I am unlovable. There's just something about me. You know, my own mama doesn't love me. My family doesn't love me. I'm just unlovable. Men come around me for a while and they love me, and then they go away. I don't know what the deal is. I'm unlovable. And she looked at me and she said, oh, Vinay, that's not so. She said, I love you. I love you a lot. And if I love you the way I do, you know God's got to love you even more. And she just reached over and kind of put, those of you who know Pat, she's about this tall, and you can see. And she just reached over and she put my head here, and she started just rocking and holding me. And I started to sob. You know, when those sobs that start down at your toes and you just cry it all the way out and there's absolutely nothing to stop it. It just comes and... And I just think that was my rebirth that night. Every nasty, ugly feeling about myself seemed to leave. What replaced it was how blessed I am and what an honor it was to have Pat even touch me, much less feel the way she feels. Yes, I betrayed God, and obviously he wasn't going to give up on me, and it was incredible. And I said, you know, on the way back, God, you just let me go back to those rooms. Because there's a lot of people that knew about this would ask me to leave. You know, they would have asked me to leave. They could have. You know, this bunch over here thought I was terrible, and this bunch said, oh, she's pitiful. And then, you know, 6 months later, these think I'm terrible, and I think I'm pitiful. You know how we do. And I thought, if I could just go back to my home group. It was a long haul. Poor old Susan and that bunch. They, for 2 years, I was just a mess. And Susan can still remember the day I first laughed. And those, you know, you can't put a price tag on the sponsorees and friends in the fellowship. Can't do it because it's so incredible. They gather you up and they hold you and they take care of you, and there's something here that you cannot ever replace. I'm going to run out of time. There's a couple of stories I really want to tell you. Jim came back in my life, and we did get married, as most of you know, and we had a rocky marriage. And places like this and things like this, you know, really helped. And they called us, Morgan, this one time and asked us to come do a couple's weekend. I said, do you know who you called? Really? Yes. And, and I told Jim, and he said the same thing. And we went, and trying to decide what to do, we picked up the AA's 12 and 12, and we got the 10th step out, because he and I had done a little workshop on that before. And we went through that AA's 10th step, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, particularly that whole weekend. And it helped a lot of people, of course, but it healed Jim and I. It healed our marriage. And we took that and we spread it around. And Jim became a different person. He came to me one time, and I love this story. I'm watching television. I'm just watching television, very engrossed, and he's in there frying a hamburger or something. And he just walks in there and stands by my chair, puts his hands on his hips. He said, listen, Missy, you say from time to time from that podium that alcoholism raises ugly head. Well, I want you to know that from time to time, alcoholism raises its ugly head. I didn't go there. I just left alone. And we lived here. We got married here, and we lived here. And then we moved to Dallas and lived there. And then we wound up. Clancy's a sponsor. Told him to come back to L.A. and put his business back together, which we did. And we had a fabulous time. We had a lot of fun. A lot of you came with us. And we were doing well. We got a place out in Palm Springs. He was going to retire out there. And he got sick, and we found out he had cancer, and he was dead in 3 months. And they, Clint's the class of 66, and Clint's the baby of 66, and there was six of them. And they came out with Clancy, and the Montana bunch was out there, and we cooked a big, because they'll have a class supper when everybody's been taken, when one of the class takes cake. And so Jim obviously couldn't go. So they came and we did a supper for him. And Jim was, by that time, he was really sick and really frail and, you know, just, and those guys came in, you know, and his shoulder came back up and he got a little color in his eyes and he sat at the table and they laughed and joked and took pictures. It's a real incredible memory. And I want to thank you for that, Clint, for coming out and helping my husband go home happy. So he's dead. Before he died, the cowboy put his arm through something, nearly bled to death, and Tracy had 10 years of sobriety, and after 10 years, for whatever reason, she sent her daughter back to live with her daddy, her Tracy's ex-husband. And a few weeks later, we gave her a big 10-year party. A lot of people came, which is glorious. And a couple weeks after that, Tracy tried to commit suicide sober. She had done this in her drinking, but this time she was sober and tried to commit suicide. And that, of course, you know, the ugliness that goes with that. And shortly thereafter, she drank, and then she got sober again, and she decided that geographic would be good, so she moved over to Phoenix, and she was in Phoenix for a while, and it's one of those times when you have to know the right question. I got a phone call, I think it was in May, late in the evening. She said, Mom, are you sitting down? Yeah, you know, that's really what you want to hear an alcoholic say to you. And I said, what? And she said, well, I went over to Las Vegas last night and eloped. I got married. I said, dude. I mean, she hadn't been dating anybody. And she told me the young man's name. His name was Shane. And I knew his parents. We all ran around together. The cowboy husband and me ran around with his parents. And I knew this kid. This kid grew up really bad. And in and out of prisons. And God, Shane? Where'd you meet Shane? Well, she met him last Christmas at the Honky Tonk. And all my kids and nieces and nephews went out dancing, just have a little fun at Christmas. And they'd been, and she just forgot to tell me that she was seeing this guy. And so I'm trying to, you know, get over the stunness of it. And I said, well, y'all going to live there in Phoenix, or are you going back to Texas? She said, well, we got to hurry up and get back to Texas before his parole officer finds out he's out of state. And then you heard the results of that last night. I think it was in January she called me, and she said, I was going to Dallas to talk at the group anniversary with Janet and them, and she called me. She said, Mom, I'm coming to Dallas, and I just need to tell you what I look like. She said, I just got out of the emergency room, and I have black eyes, and I have some stitches across my face, and I drank. And I said, well, thank you for a heads up. And I went that weekend, and sure enough, it wasn't pretty. It just was not a pretty picture. And it's one of the things that, you know, as a mother, I still pay some consequences of that stuff. It's just, she's getting beat up. She grew up seeing her mother beat up all the time, so it really wasn't any big deal to her. And I really don't want to know all about that marriage. I don't want to know. And that's when we all went, and Sheila and Renee and Ruth and the whole bunch gathered my daughter up and saved her life. And she stayed there with them and got sober again. And as you heard, she has 3 years of sobriety now, which is incredible. And her little daughter, my granddaughter's doing great, and it's wonderful. When Tracy had 1 year of sobriety, she was still living in Lubbock. And Jim and Sheila and I went back to give her 1 year cake, and my niece Tanya found out that we were coming. She called and left a message, so I got a hold of her, and she wanted to come see me, and she had a little baby, and I went and picked her up, and she was sitting on the curb under a street light, and it was cold, and she had this little baby and this little thing, and sitting on that curb, and I picked her up, and she looked terrible, and skinny, and she looked terrible. Took her out my mother's, and my mother was not pleased. Tanya was not an invited guest to my mother's house either. And she sat at the kitchen table, my mama, with her little lips pursed. And Sheila and Tracy spun the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, and talked with Tanya and took her in the bathroom, gave her a shower, did her hair. And I just heard about this the other night. I hope you don't mind us sharing it. Sheila is a manicurist that's going to do her nails. And Tanya said before she did that, she went in the bathroom and scrubbed her hands because her hands had been in places that she didn't want Sheila's hands to touch. Well, that was so touching. And they dressed her up and took her to her first AA meeting. And I have to say, I hope you see this, Jimmy, my brother. I hope you see this. My kids are saving your kids. You didn't speak to me. Look at what they're doing. And she's doing great. Tracy's doing great. You heard Sheila last night. You heard that story and how she's my soul. We're soulmates. She's my daughter. And Maria was asking me something this morning about her. And I said, you know that. We went and picked her up, and she had two boxes. She says, I don't remember the suitcase, and I don't. She had two boxes, and that was her whole life, and a screaming kid. And the next day, Sheila was laying in bed, and I went in, and she'd slept all day long. I went in to check on her, and Brad was there asleep, and she was in the fetal position. I'll never forget Sheila's face. Pain and misery, and she was just in the fetal position beside that baby. I stood at the foot of that bed and asked if God would let us help this girl get sober, and you see what a magnificent young lady she is, and her daddy was extremely proud of her. It's real funny. And this is silly women stuff, I guess. But I looked over last night, and she had this big handkerchief, and she said, it's daddy's handkerchief. And I said, oh, I have one, too. I brought daddy's handkerchief to blow my nose on at the canyon. And we hadn't spoke to each other. We just liked Daddy Texas to be with us at the canyon. Isn't that something? My son is doing fine. I quit worrying about my son a long time ago. He got married to this one little gal, and of course, I had a long divorce, but I said, how'd you and my son meet? And she said, he was out in the parking lot of the honky-tonk, and he was sick and puking, and I went over and asked him if I could help him. And he said several since then, and he's doing fine. Now we're looking at the next generation. My little Brad that was in my lap when his mama got off that plane. He's tall as I am now, and he is backing and walking. And now it's so different because I'm watching him, of course, which hurts, but it doesn't hurt as much. And what hurts is watching Sheila watch him. God, it's just, you know, this disease is... Is your family normal? Yeah, they're all alcoholics. Wait for the rest of them to come on up. But see, she talked about being surrounded last night. Tracy talked about being surrounded last night. Tanya would talk about being surrounded by people. Susan talks about, you know, we all talk about being surrounded by people. And these speakers that are here this weekend are people who have been here the past 20 years, with the exception of Dave, I think. And the board chose them to come back, and because they are